So when U.S. troops finally do leave Iraq, what happens to Iraqis left behind who helped the U.S.? Last week, Deborah had a conversation with Ziad Abdel Okwa. He's among the first of a wave of Iraqi refugees arriving in the U.S. He and his family just moved to Boise, Idaho. Deborah asked what happens to the Iraqis who have been working with the U.S. in the war effort when the troops leave.
They are in a great risk now, so what will happen if the U.S. troops withdraw from Iraq? I think that will be a disaster.
In what way? Do you think that they will be specifically targeted, specifically hunted down?
I mean, the first targets after the withdrawal will be those Iraqis who worked for American embassy, American troops. And let me tell you, all these militia groups, actually, they have our names, our addresses, our, you know, information, everything about us. They are just waiting for the right moment to go and get them.
That is Ziad Abdel Okwa. Kirk Johnson is worrying about how to get many of those targeted Iraqis out safely. He spent a year in Iraq working for the U.S. Agency for International Development, and he's back in the States now. Welcome, Mr. Johnson.
Good to be here.
Now, you have been keeping a list. Last I heard, it was over 500. Where does it stand now?
It's around 500, but since I drove over here, I know that probably another two Iraqis have contacted me this morning.
This morning?
Yeah. It's what I call the saddest list in the world. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that have been tortured. One guy's been thrown out of a moving vehicle. People have been raped. They've had family members murdered. They've been extorted. They've had children kidnapped. And this is specifically because they worked for the United States government in Iraq.
Now, we hear quite a bit about journalists and people who are helping worldwide news crews working in Baghdad, in Iraq. But who are the others that you know about? What did they do? What are they doing now?
We've relied on Iraqis for much more than just translation. USAID, for example, implemented $5.2 billion worth of reconstruction funds throughout the country. So in order to do that, we hired education experts, health experts, civil engineers. We had Iraqis running the power plants that we were building and rehabilitating. This group of people, more than any I've come into contact with in my life, they live a secret life. They have to be mindful of the checkpoint through which they entered the green zone every day to make sure that they don't walk out of the same one, because there are what are called chewers, which are militia members whose sole responsibility is to stand out front of the checkpoints to take photographs of Iraqis exiting to try to identify them as collaborators. And once they've been made by the insurgents or by the militias, it gets even worse. I have former colleagues that are hiding in their apartments in Baghdad with basically a month's worth of food and a month's worth of ammunition, and they're just sort of crossing their fingers and hoping that either the militias will change their mind, which has not proven to be the case, or that somehow the United States will come to act on what it already has admitted is a clear moral responsibility.
Mr. Johnson, is the State Department talking to you, or do you have any communication there? Do they have a list? What do they say about your efforts?
I hand-delivered the list in February the first time. That was a list of all of my former USAID colleagues that were now refugees. And since then, around every 5 weeks or so, I send them an updated list.
What else are you doing? What is your day like to try to help these people get out?
Well, I've just started a project called the List Project to resettle Iraqi allies. What this does is it takes two very prominent law firms in the country, the law firms of Holland and Knight and Proskauer Rose, who are committing to thousands of pro bono hours. So now every refugee on my list has his or her own attorney, which will give them some sort of guidance or counsel on what options are available to them and sort of helping them to get all of their documents together in advance of interviews and things like that. The other component of the project is that Amnesty International has signed on to have its chapters adopt or sponsor an Iraqi from my list to do advocacy on behalf. I'm hoping that this does take a little bit of the load off of my own shoulders. I started this all just to try to help one of my close friends, and I realized that it wasn't tenable to just turn my back on my other friends and colleagues there. But now that it's gotten into the several hundred level, I can't do it all on my own.
You were looking, as everyone is, at the March 2008 date for the withdrawal. What happens then if you still have 500 on your list or even more?
If the pace holds, I think I'll be well into 1,000 at that point, if not more. Not a single person off of my list has made it to the United States yet. I look at next year, which is a very real debate that we're in terms of what our troop levels are going to be there, but we don't have the luxury of thinking about this in any terms of abstraction at this point. These people are already being ground up in the gears. This is a very immediate crisis that is not being addressed adequately.
Kirk Johnson, he is talking with us from Boston. He's maintaining a list of Iraqis who have helped the U.S. cause in Iraq and Baghdad. Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
My pleasure.